My experience at BII has made me realize there are a whole lot of important issues out there where we need a different approach to how the research needs to be structured in order to make it viable and useful to the potential investors.
Welcome to Vox Dev Talks. My name is Tim Phillips. Chris Woodruff of the University of Oxford has pioneered academic research into businesses, large and small, in low-income countries. And that's included the use of experiments in small and medium enterprises. And he's also a non-executive director of British International Investment. That's a development finance institution and impact investor that partners with more than 1,500 businesses in emerging economies with assets of £8.1 billion, about $10 billion or euros, give or take. BII aims to bring productive and sustainable economic development to Africa, Asia, and the Caribbean. What does the operating environment of BII and the challenges it faces teach us about how research can inform policy and how we can generate the relevant, actionable research that BII might find useful? No one's better placed than Chris to discuss this. So, Chris, welcome to Vox Dev Talks.
Thank you, Tim. It's a pleasure to be here.
You joined British International Investment in 2021. Did you know them well beforehand because of the sort of work you've been doing?
Not really. And I think that's one of the things that's been quite interesting about the experience there. I can remember a teaching case that I used in a class that I taught on organizations maybe 30 years ago. And I think it was about the possibility of privatizing what was then called CDC. And so a discussion around that. And that was my first exposure to it. And then I think I didn't interact much with CDC and what has now become BII for a couple of decades. I had some familiarity with the IFC, which is a similar type organization, though multilateral rather than a single country organization. Mm-hmm. But I don't think there even that I had a deep understanding of what it is that made the IFC different from the World Bank and how they operated.
Now that you're inside BII, you can describe it to me. How does their mission differ from, well, I described them as a development finance institution. How does it differ from other DFIs?
There's a lot in common. Mm-hmm. The DFIs generally are making investments where they hope to, I mean, in BII's case, and I think this is probably not different in most of the DFIs, the sort of motto is do good without losing money. You're trying to earn a small positive return on average in the investments that you make in gross, just enough return, 2% in our case, just enough to pay the administrative costs of running the organization so that the capital gets recycled in its entirety. That's the goal. You're looking for additionality. You want to do things that the private sector is not going to invest in. Ideally, you're crowding in some private sector investment. So I think that's pretty common to all of the DFIs. And where I think BII is slightly different is, one, our focus is almost entirely on Africa and South mm-hmm. Asia, India, Pakistan, Bangladesh, Nepal. We have a new set of investments in Southeast Asia related to climate and a small amount of investment in the Caribbean also related to climate. But 60% of our investment going out the door in the last few years has been in Africa. You know, most of the DFIs are more dispersed around the world than that. Our focus is on Africa and South Asia. A second difference is, at least the difference between BII and the bilaterals on the one hand and IFC and IDB Invest and the multilaterals on the other, is we have a single shareholder. Now, everybody has shareholders. As Bob Dylan said, you have to serve somebody. But there's an advantage of having a single shareholder. And our shareholders has been very supportive in allowing BII and encouraging BII to make risky investments that have very high potential for development impact. Mm-hmm. And so what does that mean on the ground? Well, about 60% of our investments are equity. Most of the DFI's work would be at least flipped and more working in debt rather than in equity. That is the great majority of what they would do would be in debt. And we invest much more in equity. That allows us to do some things that we might not be able to do with a pure debt book.
And to be clear, the single shareholder is the UK government.
Yes, as represented by FCDO.
Right, yes. Now, you're a non-executive director. So what does that mean that you do at BII? You and your colleagues, what is your role?
Yeah, so the board sets strategy for the organization. So we think at something of a high level of what should the goals be and how do we navigate the strategic choices that the company faces. Let me just say here that the experience working with the board and the other non-executive directors has been nothing short of amazing. It's one of the privileges of my life to be involved in the conversations. I'm the only academic on the board, and quite frankly, they were probably all very skeptical of an academic coming in to the board. But they have a tremendous amount of experience investing on the ground. Two of the board members are from Africa, one is from India, and the others have substantial experience in investing. And the depth of knowledge that comes from that and the understanding of really quite a different set of firms than I've ever worked with, or quite frankly, than most researchers work with, has been amazing. But let me give one example of how the board operates and what the influence is that we have. You mentioned that BII makes investments that are productive and sustainable. We actually have a three-part development impact metric. It's productive, sustainable, and inclusive. Inclusive meaning low-income reach, meaning employees, owners, consumers who are women, meaning Black ownership and leadership of businesses in Africa. One of the things that we faced a couple of years ago when we started this impact scoring mechanism was it highlighted that we were doing amazing at finding sustainable investments, but that often those sustainable investments weren't at least directly reaching the poorest and most disadvantaged groups. The board led the discussion to say, we need to figure out how to fix this. We need to redirect and reorient towards more inclusive investments. And I think we see over the year and a half that followed that, the investment teams, the management of the company responded to that. And we did see a refocus and a re-energizing around the idea of finding more low-income reach investments. It's kind of a big picture view on things, but we engage with management in those conversations to come up with plans and ways forward on them.
A very important omission on my part. Thanks for clarifying, Chris.
Sure. You know, look, every metric that you use is going to be imperfect, but I do think that measuring at the investment level and at the portfolio level, measuring how well we're doing and finding investments that are productive, that is changing markets, generating growth, that are sustainable, that is low CO2 emission, low greenhouse gas emission investments, and that are importantly reaching low-income consumers and benefiting low-income consumers, providing good jobs for low and medium-skilled workers and so forth is a big part of the mission.
So we promised to talk about how research can inform the work of organizations like BII. But first of all, I'd like to talk about the sort of research that you and your colleagues do. I mean, your academic work, as I said, is focused on enterprises and entrepreneurs in low-income countries. Why is this an important aspect of development economics?
Yeah, so that's a good question. And again, if I think back about, you know, 30 years ago when I was an assistant professor, longer than I might want to admit, I was doing work on the footwear sector in Mexico. And I think most of my colleagues thought of me as somebody doing industrial organization, not development.
Yeah.
And so at that point in time, I think development was really focused on a set of hugely important issues on health and education and so forth, and less on growth and less on the long-term path that might help alleviate poverty over a longer period of time. And so that, I think, is why it's important that we understand this. The private sector is crucial to growth, and understanding what the constraints are to private sector growth and development, the research on private sector development, on the constraints to private sector development, help target investments towards the most effective ways of increasing growth rates and reducing, as I say, poverty over the longer term.
We spoke a few years ago, and I remember, as you were describing your research, thinking, that sounds like really hard work. What sort of questions have you been able to ask? What sort of methods have you been using to get your answers?
Yeah, so I've worked mainly with randomized control trials and with experiments, at least over the last couple of decades. That has meant that I've worked mainly with either very small firms, microenterprises, or with very large firms. And why those two groups? Well, most of the experiments, we want a sample size that's big enough that we can divide units into treatment and control. And we have enough sample to be able to do that and still have statistical power to generate results. And so with microenterprises, they're great because they're everywhere. So it's fairly easy to get a large sample of microenterprises. And with large firms, they're great because they can often be broken down into production units or production lines. I've done a lot of work with the garment sector in Bangladesh, and one large factory might have 100 production lines, 150 production lines. That gives you the possibility of doing something at the production line level that gives you a large N. So on the one hand, those are the methods I've been using. I think we've learned something. There are also limitations to that. And there's a little bit of looking for the keys where it's light rather than where you lost them, because these are the places where the methods are appropriate. The questions are important. It's good that we're able to take those methods to answer those questions. But there are other questions that are also important where maybe the RCT methods are not the only thing that we need.
How much success have we had? How strong is the evidence base in this area?
I think we've made important progress on at least some questions in ways that have helped us. Let me describe one area related to microenterprises where I think we've made progress, but where I think possibly there's still room to make more progress. We have evidence from now quite a wide set of countries and contexts that show us ways of increasing incomes of the self-employed, of microenterprise owners. This is important because about half or more of the labor force in urban areas in low and lower middle income countries is self-employed. So this is a large part of the population. It's often some of the poorest urban population. So being able to increase incomes is important. We've struggled with ways to stimulate growth and employment growth among these enterprises. And even in generating income growth, I think there's been an interesting sort of back and forth between research that I've conducted with David McKenzie, Suresh Dhamel, Marcel Fachon, Simon Quinn, and others on using grants to increase capital stock in firms and small-scale loans, microcredit, basically. Initially, we saw, geez, you give firms a small grant, they invest it in a way that generates a lot more substantial return and more income. Now, it doesn't seem to really generate a dynamic change. It sort of generates jump up in level. That jump up in level is quite important at the income levels. The loans, they were successful in generating repayments. They were not as successful in generating returns and increases in income in microenterprises. I think what's happened in the last, I'm going to say 10 years since a paper from 2013 on grace periods and microcredit, allowing more flexibility in the repayment process in microfinance has brought these two outcomes closer together. We're seeing higher return investments being made with more flexible repayments. In fact, we had a conference a few weeks ago that was supported by PEDL, the Private Enterprise Development Low Income Countries program that I help run, and BII, where we brought together practitioners and academics to talk about flexible finance for enterprises and particularly microenterprises. And I think one of the interesting parts of that conversation was, why are these, what we're learning from research, not scaling in the microfinance world? So I think there's a ways to go yet to get the research to a level that the microfinance organizations have confidence that this is right and that they should increase the flexibility of repayments at scale. And the MFIs that were there sort of said, look, we're by nature conservative. We know what works. We know what generates repayment. And so making a leap to doing something in a different way is challenging for us. So I can step back and say, what do I take away from this? You know, we've learned a lot. Grants work, but grants you know, if you talk to GiveDirectly, they'll say grants might be sustainable, and they might be. But we might think that loans are going to allow us to reach a larger number of enterprises. And we've got some interesting research that suggests that we can make loans work as well as grants. It's not really being scaled yet. We're not quite to the finish line yet, but this is an area where we've made quite a lot of progress in understanding how to make things better for microenterprise owners.
Investors like BII like to take insights, and if they want to make a difference, to apply them as widely as possible. A challenge that we talk about more or less every week on Vox Dev Talks is external validity. How big a challenge is it for the sorts of questions that you're investigating?
So I'm going to say something maybe a bit controversial. I think external validity is overplayed in this sense. I don't see it as such a big challenge. Right. Let me sort of say why I think that's the case. First of all, there's a difference between an academic standard of rigor and 95 or 99% significance and the kind of information you need to make a good business decision. And I think most business people would say, you know, give me 80-20 odds and I'm all in. Of course, we want to know this works in as big a range of places as possible. But I think that the evidence is useful in the discussions and guiding kind of how we think about investments, even when we don't have perfect external validity. That's point one. Then the second point I'd make is, I think when we see, and I'd say most of the big questions in research, we've got experiments in more than one place. We've got experiments in a few places. Now, not every place and not every context, but we have enough that you can get some intuition about what it is that's driving and why it's working better in some places than others. And I think you, at an intuitive level, and again, I think when you're making investment decisions, you're often thinking at an intuitive level, you have a sense of, we think this has a good chance of working in these contexts, and maybe we don't know enough to think about whether it works in those contexts. That wouldn't be at the top of my list. Mm. There are things I think where we need to know much more from research. External validity on the things that we have good, solid evidence in some places probably wouldn't be at the top of my list.
Tell me a little bit more from your experience about how BII makes its decisions. We've been talking about the academic evidence that you and your colleagues have managed to compile. At what stage would BII consider this evidence?
When I joined BII, I thought BIs can really generate a lot of evidence and generate an evidence in a way that's useful to them. That is by doing, say, impact assessments and things of that sort. I think that's true. And I had a conversation last week with somebody at IDB Invest, the Inter-American Development Bank's private sector investment arm, and they use the phrase doing impact assessments on some investments that are too big not to know. So I think there are places where it's true. We really do need rigorous evaluations of investments. And so there is a place for that. I think the surprise to me was that the real place that we need to use research is at the other end. It's at the front end of making investments. The portfolio is about $10 billion. We invest between $1.5 billion and $2 billion a year. Sounds like a lot of money, but it's a drop in the ocean compared to what would really be needed to invest in our markets. We know we really want to be quite careful about where we're investing and how we're investing. And the more we know about the particular levers that will really stimulate growth and development, the better off we're going to be in making investments. So I think where I'm now in my mindset is to say, what is it that we're missing that we really need to know to help us figure out what are the right places to be making investments? We're probably never going to get to a place where we can say the DFID, and I think Dean Carlin at USAID is doing some work in this as well, on best buys and really trying to sort of say what's the more precise return of different types of investment. I'm not sure we're going to get there across infrastructure, digital finance, microfinance, directed lines of credit, so forth, across the kinds of investments that we make. But having a better sense of what's the impact of these investments and where is that impact greatest is what's really going to help us target investments better.
Is the approach the type of evidence that BII uses or needs? Is it affected because it is investing hoping for a return rather than investing money from donors?
This is a really important question.
Yeah.
There's a role for both donor grant kind of investments and private sector investments. And I guess I'd say maybe even three buckets, and it's probably not buckets, it's probably a continuum. But grant-based capital, DFI-based capital, which is somewhat concessional in the sense that, again, we look for a return, but a return which is quite modest given the risk levels in the investment. And then fully commercial capital. And some problems that we need to solve, and let me talk about the climate investments that we need to make in the energy sector. We need all of that. We need to bring in commercial capital. If we don't bring in the commercial capital into decarbonizing the energy sector in South Africa, India, Indonesia, Vietnam, Philippines, middle-income countries with fairly high use of coal and CO2 emissions, if we're not able to crowd in a substantial amount of commercial capital, meaning pension funds and insurance companies and so forth, those investments will absorb all of the development aid money that's available to the detriment of the core development focus of the organization. So what do we need to crowd in that capital? Well, you need something that de-risks the investments enough that they're interesting to private capital. And that's likely to be some tranche of highly concessional, even grant capital that takes a first loss in investments and therefore makes the rest of the investment commercially viable. We want to think that these types of investments are going to be used jointly to solve a set of problems. If I think about some of my favorite investments, what I think of as our best investments, we're invested in an energy company in Eastern DRC called Virunga Energies that was started mostly with grant capital. Mm-hmm. And it got to a point where they were able, given that they had assets that were financed by grant capital, were able to take in DFI capital that allowed them to expand much more quickly because we could invest more than what grants were available. So that had the advantage of faster investment rates. It also, I think, had the advantage of more discipline for the investments and more discipline for the companies. The fact that we need to earn a return means that they have to be focused on generating revenue from consumers. So they have to be able to provide services that people want, and they have to run efficiently so that the capital that we're using in making the investments is able to get a return. And in lots of circumstances, that discipline that the private sector provides is a positive thing. So I wouldn't think of these as opposed to one another. There are lots of things where it's going to be all grants. There are lots of things where we need a mixture of grants and everything up to commercial capital. The terminology that I pick up in this, you know, the capital stack, you layer in capital at different risk levels and different return expectations, starting from grants and leading up to commercial capital. And you use that combination to make an investment that wouldn't be possible with any one of those types of capital. There wouldn't be enough grants. The commercial capital would never go in, but collectively, you're able to do something that none of you would be able to do individually. And I think that's where it works. That's the benefit of the DFIs. The DFIs are often able to catalyze the capital on either end of that stack to get these projects off the ground.
Has been part of this world influence the sort of research that you're doing, the sort of questions you're interested in asking?
It certainly influenced the questions I'm interested in. Hmm. And I am trying to get some projects off the ground, let's say, that are influenced by this. But if I think about the research in firms and private sector, both firms and labor markets, but private sector in lower middle income countries, to me, the most interesting area now is in thinking about how markets work and really thinking about markets rather than firms and the way people interact. And I think when BII invests best, I think it invests where there's a clear problem to solve. And often that clear problem to solve is something of a missing market. I'll give one example. We have a subsidiary called Gridworks that is trying to develop private sector transmission investments in Africa. There are a couple of nascent projects, neither of them really completely off the ground yet in Kenya, but there really is otherwise no private sector investment in the transmission grid in Africa. If we're going to have renewables, if we're going to have 600 million people get access to power that don't have access to power, we're going to need much more robust transmission grids. And at the end of the day, that's going to happen a lot faster if we're able to figure out how to crowd in private sector investment. Motivating that, trying to understand why it's a problem, why there isn't private sector investment in transmission, how governments and investors need to come together and what they need to do to be able to enable that private sector investment. That's a clear problem. It's a big problem. Gridworks has been around now for 5 or 6 years working on this. has some interesting projects in the pipeline. It doesn't in this area have yet a revenue stream. Mm-hmm. This is something a private investor would have never done. This is the kind of thing that DFIs can do. And if we are able to solve this problem, it could have a massive impact on welfare across sub-Saharan Africa. And so I think those are the kinds of issues that we don't get at quite well enough with research, right? I think we tend to want to have a closed, small, at least in economics, a closed, small question. And there is research out there that's useful in these conversations, but it's not where the majority of the research is. I could say the same thing with venture capital and fast-growing firms, you know, small and not big enough to have units within the company, difficult for the kinds of methods we've been using for research, but a hugely important area for growth in the private sector. So I think those are the things where my mind has shifted a bit to say, I hope I made a case before in microenterprises that we've learned a lot from these tools and techniques. And there are questions and issues that I think we've made a great deal of progress on. But my experience at BII has made me realize there are a whole lot of important issues out there where we need a different approach to how the research needs to be structured in order to make it viable and useful to the potential investors.
So what is that different approach, Chris? How can that research agenda be more strategically relevant, let's say that, to an organization like BII?
One issue that is very important in first order is to understand general equilibrium effects. I've had conversations lately with Doug Gollan, Joe Kabosky, who run the Structural Transformation Economic Growth Program at CPR, trying to join forces to say the kinds of approaches you're taking in those problems are something that we need to bring into more centrally to the way we think about what's the effect of an investment, what's the effect of an intervention, not on the recipients of the investment only, but in a more in a general equilibrium sense. And I think often we tend to focus on the investees or the treated, if it's an RCT, and not as often on the GE effects. Now, there are exceptions to that. There's some research out there that does a nice job of saying, well, what are the spillover effects? What are the general equilibrium effects? But I think we're not there yet in terms of thinking about how we do. So that's why the push on understanding markets, the push on understanding as you shock something at one place in that market through, say, an investment in a company, how does that spill over to other either upstream or downstream firms, players, consumers? That's going to require, I think, either different designs within RCTs, and there are some out there, saturation designs at the community level and these sorts of things, or a different approach which combines modeling and RCTs or modeling and empirical work. And so I think that's where I would say we need to go. Most of the DFIs, and BI is not an exception here, like to talk about the jobs they're creating. I'll say something a bit controversial. I think that's often the wrong place to look. I think our investments often, they may create jobs in our investees. Those investees may steal business from other firms. And so there may be a loss in jobs other places. But the point is that can still have a tremendously positive development impact because it changes the nature of competition. It changes the dynamic incentives in the sector. Those dynamic incentives have an effect that outlasts the investment. We need to be able to think about what are the investments that really change the incentives of the players in the market so that those players become more innovative, more efficient, more productive, and generate growth, because the investments themselves are not going to be enough if they're not levered into something that changes dynamics as you go forward. And I think that's a place where we need more research. I think we don't know enough about how to think about that in the spaces that we and others are investing in, for that matter, what some of the grant programs are doing.
Well, it's fascinating to put this different lens on the research agenda, and let's hope researchers respond. Chris, thank you very much.
Thank you, Tim.
If you want to know more about the activities of BII, well, the best place to look is on their website, which you will not be surprised to hear is biii.co.uk. This has been a Vox Dev Talk. The best way to make sure you don't miss an episode is to subscribe, follow us wherever you get your podcasts. We are there. Our past episodes, as always, are at voxdev.org. If you like what you hear, then please leave us a review and rate us and tell other people about us.